Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. Today is Monday, July 25th.
Yes, good job.
And we're telling stories this morning on the theme of telling other people's stories. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stas Steelkowski.
We're looking forward to sharing a number of tales with you. Do you want to tell us about Mr. Z?
I will. And also, I want to thank Andy Offit-Irwin for allowing us to use his original composition, Tarry Here, and for us to be using his voice and his music as he sings it. And it's beautiful and welcomes people in. So in Speak, we are back to the second Tuesday of every month, as it was in the past, and with no in-person performances for the rest of the year. So August, September, October, November, and December will all be Zoom performances, and you can get details and information about the performances at speakstoryseries.com. In August, Carrie Sue Ivar is going to be performing for us on August 9th. And she connects with people through languages and cultures and curriculums in both English and Spanish. And she's an award-winning storyteller, a Chautauqua scholar, and a national credentialed teaching artist. And she is an advocate for the art storytelling and arts education. So I'll spend in September, we have Sparky and Rhonda Rucker. They perform throughout the U.S. as well as overseas, singing songs and telling stories from American folk, spiced with humor, history, and tall tales. So Sparky and Rhonda have performed at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., Smithsonian Folklife Festival, as well as on NPR's All Things Considered, Prairie Home Companion, Mountain Stage, and Morning Edition. That'll be on September 13th, and I'm looking forward to that one.
All right. I'm looking forward to it, too.
Yeah. So so how are you this morning, today?
I'm doing well.
Good.
I'm have a lot going on, and I've told you most of the story stuff.
Yeah. You did. And you... To say you have a lot going on just means it's a normal family day.
That's right. It's just life.
It's just life. Well, I have a lot going on in my head. Not as much in my, you know, out of the house or something, but I have a lot of things going through my head and about storytelling and about getting ready for the thing at Shepherd's. I'm also considering doing something in October. If I don't go to the National Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, I'm kind of leaning to not going, but if I don't, on October 8th, the Mount St. Mary's soccer coach has invited all the former players come up and be in an alumni soccer game.
And wow.
And I would like to attend that. I would not be in the game, of course. At my age and riddled condition with all kind of replaced parts and stuff, I don't think it would be sane for me to get on the soccer field and pretend to play. So, but I would like to go and join in. And I'm guessing if I do, I might wind up being the oldest alumnus there since I graduated in 66. And my 4 years of playing soccer were from 62 to 65. And that's a long time ago.
Who will the alumni play?
I'm not sure. I haven't been up to the campus in a number of years, and this is the first time I've seen a note about an alumni game. When for 15 years after I graduated, every year I went and played, and we played against the varsity. And that was always fun. I got to be known by people on the team, even over a period of years. My reputation was that I played seriously. And at one of the games, I remember they said something about at the beginning, "Oh, watch out for the old guy." And that really irritated me because I wasn't that old. You know,
well, not as old as you are now, but you were still old to students.
I'm sure. And now I'm twice the age what I was then. So anyway, I did play 10 minutes in 1995 in the game. And I started, and then I raised my hand, I came out, and the guys on the sideline from both teams, from the alumni team and the varsity team, encouraged me to go back in. And I said, "No, thank you." I said, that was a wonderful 10 minutes and memories. However, my legs are telling me that I had enough.
What a wise man you are.
And that was a wise thing to do. You know, in my heart and mind, I still feel like I could go out on the field and give a good go, but I know better.
Okay. Well, I wish I had a soccer story to share. I don't. But I'm going to start out with a City of Hagerstown story, if that's okay.
Yes.
Are we ready to begin tellings?
Yeah. And you did announce what we were doing, right? Yes.
Yes. Okay. Our theme is telling other people's stories.
Right.
And this story is based on an interview I did with a teacher from Barbara Ingram School for the Arts in Hagerstown in the early days of the COVID pandemic. I did it by phone, several phone conversations. And she talked about her vision for the City of Hagerstown Arts and Entertainment District. So I thought it was a funny and interesting take on the world. So these are her words. "Before I came to Hagerstown, I divided my time between Washington, D.C. and New York City. My house, 45 minutes east of Frederick, Maryland, was a place to sleep a few nights a week and store my stuff, a convenient midpoint, a jumping off place to get to the urban centers in D.C. and New York. My life was the theaters of those big cities. I've always been fascinated by what communities and neighborhoods are passionate about. In 2004, my husband Dom and I were talking about retirement. A friend in real estate was looking for investors in commercial buildings and sent us to Hagerstown to look around. We could see immediately, this is a much nicer place to live than where we were, and we soon made the decision to settle here. We had few expectations of what would happen next. Our social and business life was still in DC and New York. That changed. We began to love spending time at home. This was new for us. Hagerstown is a charming town. There are some real treasures here, starting with the Fine Arts Museum and the Cultural Arts Trail. You know, the goal for the trail was to link the Fine Arts Museum with the rest of downtown. It's a very peaceful place. I come away from my walks there feeling calm, grateful, and inspired. And then the symphony, the library, Barbara Ingram School for the Arts as a cultural resource, all within 10 to 15 minutes on foot from our house. I found myself volunteering at the museum and then becoming very involved with Barbara Ingram School. Friendship and camaraderie are based on shared interests. You will always find shared interests in the arts community. Now, if you weren't born in Hagerstown, you will never be a Hagerstonian. But people are welcoming, and many share my passion for living in a vibrant community and supporting the arts locally. I wrote a 5-character, one-woman show that did very well in New York and Washington. I performed it again here in Hagerstown at the Bowman Theater in the museum as a fundraiser to raise money to install lighting in the Barbara Ingram School Theater. It was gratifying to have such good support from the community. I've been engaged with theater since I was a child. Now I'm an artist in residence at Barbara Ingram School and adjunct faculty member. My purpose in life right now is to make use of what I spent a lifetime learning. It feels good to give back, to be encouraged and assisted in doing that. Hagerstown doesn't have the energy and buzz of New York City yet, but we are growing. Now, that plaque in the sidewalk downtown, that the sparkles on the street, I've heard people say, "What is that supposed to accomplish?" Well, yes, it can seem a bit much, maybe more so on a bad news day. But those things create energy. Just like teenagers rolling out of the Barbara Ingram School downtown at lunchtime, that plaque is unexpected, celebratory, sparkly, just like those kids. If it shakes up a few people, okay, we all need shaking up on occasion. Have you stood on South Potomac Street when Barbara Ingram School breaks for lunch? You need to go there. Stand across the street and listen to the energy come streaming out of that building. These young people have a little money in their pockets and stars in their eyes. Most important, they have ideas and dreams and energy to make at least some of that come true. Now, we start at that single focus, one block area, the heart of the Arts and Entertainment District, and we work out from there. That block gives me hope. I'm encouraged. Those empty buildings in that block just suck the life right out of the room, right out of the city. Who's best equipped to develop and rehab those spaces? Who's doing the recruiting? Where's the new blood? Where are the local people doing the outreach to bring in newcomers? I'm thinking of another play I can write about a family that comes to Hagerstown. There are a few business people working hard to build this reality of young people, of families, retirees, taking day trips to visit Hagerstown. This play is not meant to be preachy. It's funny, really, at least to me as a teacher and a coach. You know how we as parents sometimes need role models and reminders in the middle of our busy lives and conflicting priorities, gentle taps to refocus on what our kids need from us in the moment. Often the rest of us, even entrepreneurs and business types, need a nudge to remember the point. What are the principles we're striving for? The belief of this city in the importance of the arts in education and in the community is tangible. It's been a fantastic experience for me to witness that passion. The Arts Council provides visible leadership. The Reborn Maryland Theater is a significant financial commitment from the community partnership that created the Barbara Ingram School. In my new play, a family comes to visit. There's a retail pop-up shop project in full swing. Those downtown experiments a few years ago provided a boost, infusion of new ideas, personalities that shook up the old guard and challenged the rest of us to step up and support, to be creative in encouraging new businesses, figuring out what might fit in our future. People did come from out of town. Residents from the county and from Frederick and Maryland. In my vision, the family takes a MARC train, a new railroad spur running from Germantown, Maryland or Martinsburg, West Virginia. In real time, transportation is a challenge. This city has not talked openly about that. Coming from larger population centers, I think a lot about resources that build creative energy for growth and development. We need a conduit for people, creative folks, to get here. Access is a requirement for growth. To sustain a regional hub, to be known for innovation and artistic creativity, you have to be open to visitors. There's evidence that we are not yet united in that understanding. In my fictional drama, seven lanes of traffic on I-70 is not necessarily the answer. In a city that values its railroad history, culture, and heritage, it makes sense that a train would be part of the solution. If you have the plaque, the sparkles on the street, the cultural arts trail, colorful sidewalks, directing visitors, you need people. It's physics. You move more people with a train, and you move individual families more often. This fictional family comes here often after their first visit, and they come on the train. What are the attractions and events once they arrive? When the train pulls in, they need to get the few blocks to the restaurants and shops that interest them. Sometimes they have grandma with them. They love the cultural arts trail and have walked it to the Fine Arts Museum, but with grandma, they opt for the little trolley that runs from the new parking deck by City Market, where the train stops, to several downtown hotspots. They've seen the golf cart-sized courtesy cars that run for special events, but grandma says the trolley reminds her of the one she rode many years ago when she worked in Philadelphia and New York, and they feel festive and welcoming to her. Papa says, everyone says Hagerstown is a traditionally automobile-crazed town from way back, and here they are with the new example of vehicle innovation. Grandma says she's read articles on Hagerstown trolleys. Ridership on trolleys is growing, bringing more Washington County residents to town. At some times of the year, volunteer docents ride the trolleys, providing historic narratives about streetcars that once ran through Maryland. This time, they take the trolley to Discovery Station Science Museum, which right now, today, in the here and now, is already a regional attraction, and in the future can be linked to the nearby child-focused recycling center with bins, educational displays, and a working recycling station where kids get hands-on experience with that process from volunteers who answer questions and offer education resources. Plus, recycling street theater, skits and interviews with passersby. Now it's Saturday in this scenario, but the family gets back on the trolley to run the block and a half to the Barbara Ingram School, where they watch a student-directed video on the history of Hagerstown's African-American community along Jonathan Street and sample snacks and smoothies from the culinary arts students at the Votech Center. The oldest child in this family, Anita, is in middle school at the time, and she picks up outreach brochures describing the curriculum at Barbara Ingram School, and she studies those materials on the way home, shares with her parents her vision of attending just such a school when she's old enough. That wistful conversation sets in motion discussions on the benefits of life in this beautiful, welcoming, small city, which eventually lead to conversations about comparative affordability of housing and the many cultural and employment opportunities. At some point, there's a visit to the new medical center and a tour of the new hospital. That was grandma's idea, really. But the result is a multi-generational relocation for two closely related households to downtown living in Hagerstown. Mama, with help from Grandma, opens a small espresso and pastry shop across from the new courthouse annex. Papa expands his Frederick City small industrial widget thingamabob doohickey laser print manufacturing business with a new site office east of the Hagerstown Library. And Anita eventually enters Barbara Ingram School and graduates with honors. She goes downstate to college, but returns to our city with her college degree after a few post-college years in Baltimore, because the theater workshop scene here in Hagerstown has taken off. In addition to the Potomac Players and the Shepherdstown Contemporary American Theater Festival close by, there are soon two artist retreat centers and a couple of old renovated historic homes on South Prospect Street, employing and hosted by working actors who regularly perform on the regional Big Five urban theater circuit of New York, DC, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and Pittsburgh. They partner here in town with the Museum of Fine Arts, our own Maryland Theater, our Maryland Symphony, University Plaza, University of Maryland at Hagerstown, Hagerstown Community College's Kepler Theater, and Barbara Ingram School's Black Box Theater. Their offerings include original and classic productions in these and other indoor-outdoor performance spaces, arts programs for children, theater training for childcare providers and educators across the lifespan, improv classes, and two new repertory groups. Needless to say, our newcomers to Hagerstown may not quite make it to happily ever after, but they do look forward to long and satisfying lives in their new adopted city.
Wow. Very nice.
Very that nice. Was Dale Stein, who's a teacher at Barbara Ingram School, and it was funded by the Maryland Arts Council and Hagerstown's own cultural arts programs.
Wow. Yeah.
I'm required to say that every time I tell a story from that scene.
Oh, sure. Sure. you have to pay homage to the gods of the money,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So, well, that was very interesting.
She was quite a hoot. She had so many, the ideas just tumbled out of her. There's a lot more to the interviews I did with her, but that, yeah. That's making it into one story anyway.
Well, sounds like she's doing well.
Oh, yeah.
And
she's come to some of my story events as well. So I've gotten critiques from her as an arts teacher.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she's given me great feedback.
Good. That's good. Well.
So you have a story?
I do.
Well, we should probably tell our listeners that they've tuned in to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour, that I'm Fanny Crawford. And
I'm Stosh Siolkowski.
We're telling stories today that came from other people, telling other people's stories.
Right. And I was in Hagerstown just yesterday and had lunch with one of my friends, one of the few friends that I have in this area, since I don't spend as much time as I did before doing things. Mark Brew and I had lunch together, and we had a wonderful couple of hours discussing everything, anything and everything, and fixing almost no problems with the world. But we had no trouble deciding on what to have for a late breakfast and good coffee and conversation. So.
Where did you go?
We went to a place just off of Eastern, on Eastern Avenue, a shopping center, and I think the place was called Jay's.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
I'm going there for lunch today.
You are?
I am. Jay's Diner.
That's wonderful. Yeah. I recognized it when we got there, that Terry and I had stopped once in that shopping center, because I had a doctor's appointment, which is right across a little street from the shopping center with my eye doctor. And so then we went walking around that little shopping center and found the diner, and it was quite nice. And yesterday we had, Mark and I had a nice time there. So
that's it was very good. I'm glad to hear that. I haven't heard much from Mark recently, so I'm glad to hear.
And he and I went to lunch about a month ago and decided that we should try to do, you know, stay in touch that way. Since we no longer live in Sharpsburg, and the place where we often would see Mark and his wife, Julia, was at Bender's. We sometimes would go there. And I used to be on the trivia team on Monday nights there. However, I've stopped doing that because I don't like driving home in the dark.
Right. You don't live there anymore.
Right. Right. So, well, so.
Ready for a story?
I do. And my story is an interesting thing. If anyone who knows me at any level at all would think this is a strange choice for story, because I do not have pets. And many people who know I don't have pets, without any good reason, think I don't like animals. I've had people actually tell me that to my face. Well, you must not like animals. I don't dislike animals. In fact, I have taken care of animals in my life, and I'm very kind to animals. And I just don't like having a responsibility for something like that. So here we go. This is a story about a 53-year-old man and his black border collie, whose name was Saul. They were on a hike in California's Tahoe National Forest, surrounded by trees and steep canyons, when something went wrong. The man fell 70 feet from a ridge, breaking his hip and multiple ribs. The authorities, that's what the authorities reported. He had no phone with him, but his dog was by his side. The man, whose name the authorities did not release, crawled up a rocky bluff to his camp where he had been staying, and was able to retrieve his cell phone. And he called 911 and asked for help. This was reported by Sergeant Dennis Hack of the County Sheriff's Office. About 7 hours later, volunteers with the Nevada County Sheriff's Search and Rescue Group came across Saul in the forest. The dog was jumping up and down, spun around in circles, and ran 20 feet ahead of them. So that's what the Sergeant Hack reported. Then Saul looked back at the volunteers, and Sergeant Hack said, it was as if to say, he was saying, follow me. I think this dog is trying to lead us somewhere. The sergeant recalled a volunteer saying by radio, so we're going to follow him. Well, Sergeant Hack and others at a nearby command post were puzzled. We didn't put a whole lot of faith in it, but I do put a lot of faith in our searchers, because they're extremely good at what they do. They followed Saul for about 200 yards, and there, lying on a bed of dirt covered by a camouflage tarp, was the injured man. He was in a lot of pain, but so grateful for his loyal pet and the volunteers. The Sergeant Hack reported that he was pleasantly surprised because he lived a somewhat secluded lifestyle, and he was glad to be taken by helicopter to a hospital with injuries that were not life-threatening, although they were serious. The area where the man had been hiking was inaccessible to vehicles, so it prompted 25 volunteers from the Nevada County Sheriff's Search and Rescue to look by foot, which is, I think, is one of the strangest things I've ever read, looking by foot. I think they meant searching on foot or by foot. other agencies went to the park and searched for the man whose friend had shared photos of Saul with the authorities as the search began. It was immediately clear to search crews that Saul wanted them to follow behind. And Sergeant Heck told the reporters, one of the guys said made eye contact with him. After Saul led the search crew to the man, the collie was taken to a local nonprofit in the area that takes care of animals and was eventually reunited with his owner. The rescue stories like Saul's are rare, and the science is not yet settled on whether dogs can intentionally seek out other humans to help their distressed owners. I've heard lots of stories in my life of dogs who have helped to rescue people. Of course, the famous television show Lassie. Every week, Lassie rescued somebody and did some great things. Sergeant Hack said that while he and the other rescuers admired Saul's loyalty, he believed the searchers dispatched that they would have eventually found the man. I think that's true. They would have eventually found the man. However, they wouldn't have found him quite as fast. The day after being found with the help of Saul, the man was in the hospital telling people that he was desperate to be reunited with his dog. Later that afternoon, the man picked up Saul, who had spent the day being petted and praised. And better yet, Sergeant Heck said, he was given an extra prize fit for a good dog, a beef jerky stick. So the tale had a good end, even with broken ribs and a broken hip.
That's a great story. And you tell it so well.
Oh, that's because I do love animals and respect them.
I wanted to tell our listeners that if anything you've heard so far is remotely interesting, you can hear a lot more at talltales.enlightenradio.org. From the past 4.5, almost 5 years, right?
A long time.
We're doing this
today. I think our first broadcast was sometime in 2017.
Yes, I think you're right.
In the fall of 2017, I believe.
So we're almost there.
That's coming up on at least pretty soon.
We should have an anniversary show.
Yes, we should.
Close.
Where we can tell anniversary stories.
Okay. So shall I tell my 5-minute story? But I think you have a longer story you wanted to tell.
I do have a longer story, but I'm curious. I'd like to hear your 5-minute story. We've been on the air now for 28 minutes, according to me.
Right. So we have time for your longer story.
Okay.
Actually, we've been on longer than that.
Really?
Yeah.
How much?
We've been on at least 32 minutes.
32 minutes. Okay, that makes sense.
Time. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I would like to, Okay. Let me do this.
Okay.
All right. All right. So Michael Hingson is the focused person that this story is focused on. He was born blind. That's what he normally tells people. But in an interview, he revealed that technically no, but in fact, yes. Technically no, because I was born 2 months premature. And he was put in an incubator and given a pure oxygen environment, which caused the retinas of his eyes to malform, which caused his blindness. So technically, 2 days after I was born is when he became blind. So Michael Hingson was born in 1950. He lives now in Victorville, California, with his wife, Karen. Back in 2001, he lived in Westfield, New Jersey, and and commuted into Manhattan every day for work. He was the regional sales manager and head of operations for a company that provided data protection and network storage systems. His office was on the 78th floor of Tower 1 of the World Trade Center. In 1999, Michael had gotten his fifth guide dog. Her name was Roselle. They worked well together, but for all Roselle's professionalism, she was very afraid of thunderstorms. Roselle was a yellow lab. She'd been trained at Guide Dogs for the Blind in San Rafael, California. And within 2 days of her arrival to Michael's house in New Jersey, she was already going to work with him every day. In the early morning hours of September 11th, 2001, Roselle woke Michael up. She was panting and shivering, and he knew this meant the storm was coming. Got out of bed and went down to the basement, had an office down there. He put on some loud music and worked at his desk, keeping Roselle company. The dog really did not like storms and crouched under his desk. Anyway, that day, when Michael did go into work, and of course Roselle went with him, they had ordered breakfast for their trainees that were coming in to the center, and he got to work setting up the conference room. He met with his colleague, a man by the name of David Frank, who was based in California, but they come to town for the day's seminars. Some attendees had already arrived and were eating in the conference room. David and Michael Hinkson were in his office. Roselle was asleep under the desk. Roselle's typical job in the office was to be the official greeter. If anyone opened the door, Roselle was up. She'd go out and say hello and visit and then come back and lay down and go to sleep. On the morning of September 11th, Roselle was asleep under Michael's desk with her head on his foot. He remembers that he and David were discussing the easiest way to get the rest of the visitors through security at the World Trade Center and decided they would fax a list of names on company letterhead. Suddenly, as he was reaching for a piece of paper to create the list, he heard a muffled explosion. It wasn't very loud. The building kind of shuddered. And then he felt it as if the building was leaning a bit. And it did lean. And in no time at all, it leaned back. Michael and David actually said goodbye to each other because they thought they were about to be going 78 floors, plunging to the street below. At first, they had no idea what had happened, and they could imagine all kinds of things. They thought there was a fire or something. David had pointed to the windows, and actually, in his excitement, said, "See, look out there." Of course, Michael couldn't see out there because he's blind. And they decided to try to determine exactly what happened. In no time at all, they were alerted because of information passed throughout the building that a plane had hit the building. And there was fire above them. And they decided that the only thing to do, since the building seemed to be on fire up near the 90th floor, was that they should go to the stairwell and work their way down. They could not use the elevators, of course. The elevators were not working and shouldn't work during fire. So out into the hallway they went, and they started to be going downstairs from 78 floors up. And actually, the plane had hit almost 20 stories above, 18 stories above, so on the 96th floor. But they didn't know that detail then. So people were screaming. There was all kind of commotion. But they moved out of the conference room, and they were telling people, "We've got to get out of here. the building's on fire. We can't stay here. We've got to get out right now. And I, Michael, in replying about questions about this, said, slow down, David. I had to keep telling him, slow down. You don't understand. You can't see it, David replied. But the problem wasn't that, what I wasn't seeing. The problem was what David wasn't seeing. And that was Roselle. Even with all the screaming and the Roselle, the dog, the screaming and debris falling, she stayed calm. This was the most important information to Michael. They were a team and he trusted her judgment. I knew Roselle's behavior, by her behavior, that we were not in such imminent danger and that we could not try to evacuate, that we could try to evacuate in an orderly way. I told you what Roselle was like when she was afraid of thunder. She wasn't doing any of that. She was sitting by my side, yawning and wagging her tail, looking for scratches, not giving any indication of fear at all. So I wasn't distracted by things that I wasn't seeing. Maybe that was an advantage of being blind. So I focused. David left and took our guests to the stairs. There were five, I believe. And I told David, when we're done, come back and we'll sweep the office and we'll leave. Meanwhile, I called my wife at our home in New Jersey and told her that there had been an explosion or something happened and said, we're going to leave. And she said, well, what's going on? That was an explosion. And then I'll find out and then I'll call you. David came back. We swept the office, tried to power down some equipment. Now, that swept the office meant they checked all the different equipment in the office, turned power off to everything. And we really didn't think we had the time to do it all. We just left and went to the stairs and started down. So now it's 10 of 9 in the morning, 4 or 5 minutes after the attack on our tower. As soon as we got to the stairwell, I began smelling an odor that seemed familiar. I just couldn't place it at first. Took me about 4 floors to recognize what I was smelling. What I was smelling were the fumes from burning jet fuel, the same thing that I smelled every time I went to an airport. I observed that the people around us, and they said, yeah, we're trying to figure out what it is, but you're right, it is burning jet fuel. We still didn't really know what was going on. We walked down the stairs some more. We got down about 10 floors, and then above us, we heard a voice that yelled, burn victim coming through, move to the side of the stairs. By now, the stairs were packed with people moving in a downward direction. And the stairs were wide enough that we could move to the side and we could walk 2 or 3 abreast. So we all moved to the outer wall and turned facing inward. And this group of people surrounding a woman who was very badly burned on the upper part of her body passed us by. We went down a few floors more and heard the same thing. Burn victim coming through, move to the side. And David said this person was even worse than the other one. They were both able to walk and were going down the stairs with them. Now, each floor had 19 stairs split into 2 flights. The first had 10 steps, then a landing where you turn and 9 more steps. Michael doesn't normally count steps. It's the dog's job to pause at the top and the bottom of each set. But on this day, Michael says he did count. To occupy his mind, he counted and he listened, trying to make sense of what had happened. The other people in the stairwell were quiet and focused. There was no cell phone reception, so they didn't have any information from outside. They just walked. He said it felt hypnotic, unreal sometimes. Sometimes the smell of jet fuel went away, and sometimes it was very strong. Michael could hear the dog breathing. Roselle seemed to be breathing normally and was focused. She clearly had the sense that people were afraid and that something was going on. It was important for me to urge her and encourage her. So I started acting out of the and do her job, because if she was acting out of the ordinary, then my immediate belief would be there must be something wrong. So it was important for me to focus on encourage her. Good girl, Roselle, I said. Oh, what a good dog. Keep going forward. Good dog. What a good dog. And doing that all the way down the stairs. The other reason for doing that was that I needed to convey a message to her that I wasn't worried. Because if I started acting afraid or worried, then she's going to be looking at me and going, are you okay? Or rather than doing her job. we worked together and we knew each other well. So, and we knew each other well enough that I knew that's what she would do. When we made it from the 78th floor to the 50th floor, Michael is telling us that he remembers that David said that we're going to die. We're not going to make it out of here. But Michael Hinkson said, "Stop it, David. If Roselle and I can go down these stairs, so can you." He told me later that this brought him out of his funk. And what he then decided to do was walk a floor below me. And as he put it, he wanted to think about something else. So he was going to walk ahead of us, one floor below each time, and describe what he saw on the stairs. David would say, "Michael, we're at floor 51, then floor 49. And each time Michael Michael Linson said, so when he got a floor below me, then I would hear things like, "Hey, Mike, I'm at the 48th floor. Everything's clear here. Everything is good." He was very encouraging, and that helped a lot. The one thing that was most important about what David did was that as he was shouting, 47th floor, all clear here, anyone with the sound of his voice heard him and knew that somewhere on the stairs, above them or below them, somewhere on the stairs, people were okay. And he gave people something to focus on. I think that we had to work together to keep panic out of the stairwell. So, for example, after two burn victims passed by us, a woman suddenly stopped on the stairs and said, "I can't go on. I can't breathe. We're not going to make it out of here." And about eight or nine of us, we went and had a group hug. I and the other people surrounded her, and we just hugged her, and Roselle gave her lots of kisses, and we encouraged her, and I said, "Come on, you can do this. Yeah, come on, you can go down the stairs. We're together, we're okay. We got to the 31st floor." David was on the 30th, and he said, "Hey, I'm on the 30th floor, everything is clear. By the way, firefighters are coming up the stairs. Everyone move to the side and give them a place to go by." So what do you see when I got down to David? And I asked, he said, "They're carrying oxygen cylinders, fire access shovels, and all the things that they need to fight the fire." And about that time, the first guy got to us and he stopped. He stopped right in front of me and said, "Hey, buddy, you okay?" And did he need to speak that loud? No, because blind people don't see, but we do hear very well. But I said, "No, I'm fine. Don't worry about it. That's nice." He said, "We're going to send somebody down the stairs." And I said, no, really, don't. I don't need any help going down the stairs. I just came down from 78th floor and we're going on down fine." Yeah. Well, I finally convinced him that I really didn't need any help. And I pointed out that blindness doesn't make me incapable of walking downstairs. In fact, typically people, if they're going to try to help you, they'll grab your arm or else ask you to grab their elbow, which is fine if I need guiding. But then when they get to stairs, the people will try to kind of lift you up so that you don't fall down the stairs. You can't get lost going downstairs. There's no greater likelihood that I'm going to fall on the stairs if I'm using a dog or a cane than a sighted person is going to fall on stairs. But this gentleman insisted he had to help. And finally, I said, "I've got my guide dog. We're doing fine. We really ain't well." Finally. And I reminded him, don't pet the dog, not when the dog is in harness. The dog is working. It also wasn't the time to give him a lecture. Blindness isn't the problem. It's your misconceptions that are the problem. I did not tell him that, but I felt like I should at the time. Finally, I got him to allow us to go on. "Look, I've got my friend David here who can see, and we're working well together." So he turns to David, and David says, "Yeah, leave him alone. He's good." And we went on. By the way, David reassumed his scouting position on the floor below us and again started shouting up. When we got to the 26th floor, David said, "People are passing out bottles of water. Somebody opened the water vending machine, and Mike, I'll bring you a bottle." So he got some bottles out of the vending machine. David brought some water up to me and Roselle, I knew she was thirsty. And so David and I poured some water into our hands, maybe cupped our hands a little bit so that Roselle could get a drink. And more firefighters began to pass us. And sometimes the people in the stairwell would break into applause for the firefighters going up. The closer they got to the bottom, the faster Michael wanted to go. But it was now very crowded. People evacuating on the right side, firefighters coming up on the left. Finally, Michael was on the second floor and heard David call out that he was on the first floor. David yelled up that the sprinklers were on and that Michael should be prepared to run through water. We got to the first floor, Michael said, and it was very noisy. I described the curtain as a kind of waterfall, the curtain of water. It sounded like a waterfall, and it sounded like a little waterfall or maybe a decent sized one, but there's a lot of water that was coming down right in front of me. I picked up Roselle's harness. I told her to go forward. I used a command called hop up, which is to speed up and pay attention. And we ran through the water, came out the other side into the lobby of One World Trade Center. Michael told Roselle she'd done a great job. She rubbed her cheek against his hand. And then David said to Michael, let's go. The guys run up to us. And this guy runs up to us and introduces himself as somebody from the FBI, and he would get us where we need to go. My first question was, what's going on? And he said, there's no time to tell you now. I wish he had. For me, information is important. And there wouldn't be anything that he could tell me that would cause me to panic, as opposed to how I used that information to stay alive. But I got no information. Finally, when we went through the complex, we went up an elevator and finally outside as far away as we could be from the Twin Towers. As soon as we got outside, David looked around and said, Mike, I see fire in Tower 2. We didn't know where it came from. Maybe when our tower tipped, because it did tip in that direction, maybe the fire jumped across or something. We had no clue. We walked north on Broadway, and then David asked if they could stop because he could see the fire very clearly in Tower 2 and wanted to take some pictures. So we stopped. I called my wife on the phone and could not get through because the circuits were so busy. As we learned later, of course, people who were up in the towers were saying goodbye to loved ones. And I had just put my phone away, and David was putting his camera away when a police officer yelled, get out of here. Get out of here. It's coming down. We heard this rumble, then became this deafening, roaring sound. You could hear glass breaking, metal clattering, then this white noise sound of the building just collapsing, going straight down. People panicked then, of course. They turned and ran. I turned with Roselle and started running back the way I'd come. So now running south on Broadway, because there was a building on my right and Broadway was on my left side. And I remember thinking, as soon as we started to run, I can't believe that you got us out of this building just to have it fall on us. A little silent prayer. And as soon as I thought that in my head, I heard a voice as clearly as you hear me. Don't worry about what you can't control. Focus on running with Roselle. The rest will take care of itself. I have no idea where that voice came from. This felt like there was some kind of sense of security and that if we worked together, it would be okay. So we ran west on Fulton Street, and almost immediately were engulfed in dust clouds, all of the dirt and the debris and the fine particles of Tower 2 breaking up and collapsing. We knew we had to get it out of that dust. And as we were running, I told Roselle, right, because we're running next to a building on our right. And I wanted to find the first opening and go into the building. I was giving her hand signals and speaking as loud as I could. I don't know whether she could hear me over all the noise. I don't know whether she could see my hand signals. But suddenly, on my right-hand side, I heard an opening. But obviously, Roselle knew what I wanted. She turned right into that opening. She took one step, and she stopped. And she would not move. Come on, Roselle, keep moving. She didn't move. And I realized, first of all, run with Roselle, and the rest will take care of itself. But more importantly, I realized maybe she's doing her job. So I investigated with a hand along the wall, stuck out a foot, discovered that we were at the top of a flight of stairs. She indeed was doing exactly what she had been trained to do. No matter what I said, she was using the system that we call intelligent disobedience. She wasn't going to let us fall down the steps. She stopped and waited until she got the appropriate command to walk forward and go down the stairs. Well, before we went down the stairs, she got a hug. Then we went down the stairs. I told her forward, and we went down the stairs. And we walked down two flights and found ourselves in this little subway entrance. It's a little arcade entrance to the Fulton Street subway station at that time. Michael heard a woman on the ground asking for help. She couldn't see, she said. Her eyes were full of dirt, and she was scared she was going to fall onto, that she might fall on the subway tracks. Michael reached out and took her arm. Hey, don't worry. My name is Mike. By the way, I happen to be blind, but I also know you're about 10 feet away from the stairs, so you're safe. Try to clear out your eyes and what's your name? And she introduced herself. We stood there and she talked a little bit. And then this guy came up from the subway system and he said that his name was Lou. He was an employee. And he said, I'll take you down to the employee locker room. There were about 8 or 9 of us there. And he said, I'll take you on down to the employee locker room where you can all sit. There are benches, there's a water fountain, so on. We were coughing and hacking and just trying to get the stuff out of our lungs. And a police officer showed up and arrived and said, you all need to leave this area now. The air is better up above. You need to leave right now. He didn't wait for a discussion, just turned and walked away. We all got to follow up. Michael and David and the other people from the subway station went back outside. And that's when David told Michael that Tower 2 was completely gone. We weren't sure what was going on, of course, and we just walked for a while. And then suddenly we heard that freight train waterfall sound again. We thought that probably it was our tower. And David looked back and indeed, he saw a dust cloud coming from our tower, told me there was another dust cloud coming. We moved to the side out of the way of most of it, and kind of hunkered down and waited for the noise and everything to subside. Once it did, we stood up. David looked back and he said, oh my God, Mike, there is no World Trade Center anymore. And I asked him, what do you see? And he said, all I see are fingers of fire and flame, hundreds of feet tall, pillars of smoke. It's gone, Michael. It's gone. It's not there. Michael said at that time, he felt like his heart broke. He thought about the people still in the tower that he and Russo had just come down from. We stood there a moment and I tried to call my wife. This time I was able to get through, and she's the one who first told us how terrorists had hijacked 2 aircraft. Excuse me. Sorry, I lost me. The towers had been hit by 2 planes, and excuse me. Pardon, I got stuck in. We were exhausted, needed to find somewhere to go. And we went to an apartment of one of David's friends. I couldn't really relax. I wanted to get home. I needed to be with Karen. And we were still clearly in shock. That was about 1:30 in the afternoon. So really, it wasn't until I got home that I was able to just slow down and start to truly think about it. Michael was asked later in an interview, how was Roselle when you got home? I imagine she had been just exhausted. Mike said she was great. She was just another day at the office for Roselle. Obviously a little bit different, but she did exactly what she was supposed to do. I did ask the people from Guide Dogs for the Blind a couple days later, will this affect her? And what I was told was, actually, I was first asked a question, did anything hit her? Was she hurt in any way? And I said, no. And they said, no, probably it won't affect her at all because dogs don't do what if, which is, I think, one of the best lines in the story. Nothing bothered her specifically. She focused and did exactly what she was supposed to do. When it was over for her, it was over. So they don't go, the dogs don't go back and think about, oh my gosh, what if I didn't do this or what if I didn't do that? It's done, and the proof, the best proof I can give is that when we did get home that night, I took her harness off. I took her outside, but she immediately ran off, grabbed her favorite rope bone, and started playing tug of war with my retired guide dog, Linny. And so they just played. To trust an animal in an emergency is a remarkable thing. The trust that Michael had for Roselle and the job that she was going to do was unbelievable. I believe that true dogs do love unconditionally, but they don't trust unconditionally. The difference between dogs and people is that we're mostly kind of learned in society not to trust, which is extremely unfortunate because of what it also has caused us to be like. Pardon me. One interesting thing about this story with Michael Hinks and Roselle is that Roselle did suffer because of the being in the tower that day and all the dirt and dust and things. She contracted a disease which was immune-mediated thrombocytopenia, something that both humans and canines can catch. It's caused by either a genetic issue or by ingesting toxins, which of course she did on September 11th. And that's why we think she caught the disease. They were able to treat her for the disease for several years. But in March of 2007, when Roselle retired, she spent her retirement at home, relaxing with Michael and Karen. In June of 2011, Michael wrote on his website, "I have the solemn obligation to inform you that my hero guide dog, Roselle, passed away. And I'm sad, of course, because I'll miss her." At the end of the post, he addresses Roselle. He writes, "Help us to be better people." An interesting thing, guide dogs for the blind also retired in the name Roselle. That is the end of the story. Roselle. There will never be another guide dog named Roselle.
Thank you, Stash. Amazing. Amazing telling, amazing story. You've been listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stash Zielkowski.
We've been telling on the theme of telling others' stories, other people's stories. And you've just heard a 9/11 heroic story about a dog and a man who survived. Wow.
I didn't think it was going to be that tough to tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it was very moving. Thank you.